10 minutes past 7 o'clock. I'm Jamoke Fashalam. Now, PrEP, which is pre-exposure prophylaxis, is a drug which has been shown to reduce the risk of HIV infection by more than 90% among gay men. The once-a-day pill, which costs £400 a month per person, works by disabling the virus to stop it multiplying. The idea is to give it to uninfected men who are having unprotected sex with other men. Back in August, the High Court ruled that NHS England does have the power to fund the HIV preventative drug. However, the NHS will appeal against the High Court ruling because providing the £5,000 annual patient cost will hit funding for 13 other treatments. And also, some critics warn it is a strategy fraught with dangers. Well, joining me to explain more is Dr. Peter Saunders, who's the chief executive of the Christian Medical Fellowship. Peter, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Good morning.
Just explain from your perspective exactly, you know, what this drug is.
Okay, well, PrEP, as you've said, pre-exposure prophylaxis. It goes under the trade name of Truvada, and it consists of two antiretroviral medications. So the medicines, if you like, which kill the virus that causes AIDS. And people who are extremely high risk of contracting AIDS, or HIV, but don't already have it, can take this drug. They take one tablet a day, as you've said, costs £400 a month, or the order of about £5,000 a year, and the total cost to the health service would be in the order of about £10 to £20 million per year. And it does reduce the chances of transmitting HIV from a person who's infected to a person who's not infected. So in other words, it's for people who are not infected with HIV, but who are at extremely high risk of getting it because of the sexual behaviours in which they're participating. And the question that the court looked at was whether the NHS in England was obliged to provide it, and the NHS England were ruled against, but they had argued that because this is a harm reduction mechanism or a prevention mechanism, it should not be their responsibility. It should be the responsibility of local councils, you see. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that's what the whole debate's been around, whether the taxpayer should fund a drug which, in effect, is reducing the chance of very high-risk individuals contracting an illness which is related to their behaviour. So that's why it's such a big issue.
And of course, what impact would it have in terms of other illnesses? So on balance, something has to give if they were to go ahead and provide this drug.
Yeah, well, we all know that the NHS is cash-strapped. We know that every government increased healthcare spending from the beginning of the NHS by between 3 and 5% up until 2010 when the coalition government began. And since then, it's been 0.75% per year. And this is why the NHS is in such a dire state, with many trusts going over their budgets and with healthcare professionals, doctors, nurses and others on the front line being under tremendous pressure. So it's not surprising that people are therefore asking questions about what treatments it should provide. And as you know, that the costs of some treatments for some cancers, for example, are no longer being recommended because they're not seen as cost effective. Mm. Now, of course, this particular drug, Truvada or PrEP, NICE, you know, the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, just last week actually published a summary on the evidence for Truvada. And I know the main figure that's tossed around is 90%, but actually, if you look at the NICE figures, they say it's between 44 and 86% reduction. And if you look at the Cochrane studies, which are the very authoritative UK-based studies which look at evidence from all around the world and all the journals, they quote about 51% reduction. And it depends very much on... So it's a lot lower. So you're certainly reducing your chances of getting HIV, but the chances of reducing it are a lot less than is the 90% reduction that's been quoted. And so some people will argue it's like playing Russian roulette, but you only have a bullet in every second barrel, if you like.
You don't sound as though as if you think that, given what you've just quoted, the nice figures and other figures, that actually, in effect, it should be seen as this alternative to for prevention. You seem in some ways to be leaning towards the money would be better spent in areas like cancer, etc.
Well, I think when health resources are short, you've got to ask these questions. I mean, lots of people are asking, you know, should we be making a real priority of providing treatments which are related to, you know, certain behaviours and which are of very high risk that people deliberately engage in. So, you know, there is a debate around various treatments or preventions for obesity, drug addiction, smoking, alcohol, all that kind of thing. I mean, it's not surprising that taxpayers will ask these questions if they hear that the NHS is having to cut other sorts of treatments. And this is why there's a debate. And I think NHS England are concerned about this for several reasons. Firstly, because they don't think this is a prevention, or they think this is a prevention method, which it is. I'd argue it's not even prevention. It's about harm reduction. But also because they have doubts about the effectiveness of the strategy, because the figures I've just quoted, the danger that it might create a precedent for them having to fund other disease prevention measures. You know, should they have to fund people getting sunscreen so as to reduce their chances of lung cancer? And the other thing is about resources being drawn from other pressing priorities. So that's why there's
that there has been such a, as we know, the devastation that HIV has caused over the years, and that actually anything, even if it is a 50% chance of reducing the potential, you know, in the next 20, 30 years for it continuing, would be of value.
Yes, you could argue that way, and certainly certain groups are, and this is why they took the NHS England to court. But my point is that when you've got something that's nowhere near 100% effective, that it creates precedence for other treatments, that it draws resources from other priorities, then I think there is a debate to be had. And I mean, if it won't be perfectly blunt, you know, that we're talking here about, we're not talking about, you know, people who are being faithful to one partner for life, or having a very small number of partners, or who are only having certain kinds of sex, who are very, very low risk for getting HIV. We're talking about a very small subset of the largely male homosexual population who are, you know, doing two things. Firstly, that they are extremely promiscuous in the sense that they're having, you know, often tens, hundreds, even more partners, many of whom they don't know, and that they are also engaging in certain sexual practices that are known to be very high risk for transmitting the HIV virus. I mean, if I might be permitted on a Sunday morning, I know you've been talking about words that we can and can't say already, but I mean, if you have anal sex, for example, then you run 18 times the risk of transmitting the HIV virus than you do with vaginal sex. In the same way, the risks for anal cancer, which is a disease particularly that male homosexual population are at risk of because of certain sex practices, the incidence of anal cancer or cancer of the anus in male homosexuals is 35 times what it is in heterosexual males. So the point is, if you have lots of partners, if you obviously if you're not wearing condoms as well, which many people still don't, if you are engaged in certain forms of sexual practice, then you run a high risk of getting HIV.
So you're saying, you seem to be implying that becomes a license for promiscuity.
No, I didn't say that. I'm saying, but I think there is a debate over. I mean, there is a debate over if people are using PrEP, might they then take more risks? And I think that's a debate that's being had in the medical journals at the moment. But it's what we call the seatbelt phenomenon, or or risk compensation. You know, it's well known that, for example, the advent of seat belts certainly reduced some forms of injury, like head injuries. People mm-hmm. weren't being thrown through windscreens anymore. But actually, there were a number of motor vehicle accident injuries that stayed at the same level, and that was because people felt safe, they drove, they took more risks, they drove more recklessly. And the whole question of, you know, I think it is an issue to ask the question, if I think I'm going to be protected, am I going to take more risks? And, and let's remember that HIV is not the only sexually transmitted disease. There are a whole lot of others which PrEP, of course, does not protect you against.
What would you like to be seen to be done? Would you prefer the NHS not to provide this at all?
Well, I think that's a question for healthcare providers and people who divide up budgets. I think when we've got people who are not getting treatments for certain other conditions, you've got to ask the question about what the priorities are and what taxpayers' money should be diverted into. But I think there's another question that's not really being addressed here, and that is a certain very small group who are having lots of sexual partners and being engaged in unsafe sexual practice. And often this is also of an addictive nature. You know, when people carry on doing things that are very dangerous for their health in a compulsive, almost compulsive way, I think we have to ask ourselves, what are we doing to reduce the kinds of behaviours that a small subset of the population are being engaged in? Because there are other ways of doing it, and I think it's a much bigger question than just, putting in PrEP.
Okay. Dr. Peter Sanders, thank you ever so much for joining us this morning.